Good evening. When the Territory of Michigan granted a charter to the Detroit and Pontiac Railroad in 1830, it was the first railroad company to be incorporated west of the Alleghenies. The Erie and Kalamazoo Railroad, chartered in 1833, was projected as a connecting link between Lake Erie and the Kalamazoo River. The plan was to build from Toledo on Lake Erie to Marshall on the Kalamazoo. That goal never was achieved, but the Erie and Kalamazoo was the first line to lay rails in the Old Northwest, and it was the first one to put into operation a steam locomotive. The 33 miles from Toledo to Adrian were in use by 1836. This railroad corporation is still in existence, and it pays an annual dividend to its stockholders. Every year, the directors meet in Adrian, receive their check from the New York Central, which has a perpetual lease of the line, deducts expenses, and declares the usual dividend. The rails on the Erie and Kalamazoo were wooden, with an iron strap fastened to the top. The first locomotive was comparatively a toy, but it ran. The first passenger coach was a top-heavy affair and was called a pleasure car. It carried about 20 persons. The seats were benches along the sides and the door opened on the side. Later on, a curiously modern note was introduced in the shape of double-deck coaches. The upper deck, which was more luxuriously furnished, was reserved for the ladies. The freight trains hauled about 6 cars, each one capable of carrying 6 tons. The engine developed about 20 horsepower, and it was fueled from the wood stacked along the tracks at various points. By 1837, there were at least 20 railroad companies chartered in Michigan, but very few rails had been laid. One line destined to become very important to Kalamazoo, the Detroit and St. Joseph, had only graded about 10 miles between Detroit and Ypsilanti. In 1837, the Territory of Michigan officially became a state. And that same year, the new state legislature undertook a grandiose series of projects for internal improvement. 3 railroads and 2 canals, with several branches, were to be built across the lower peninsula from east to west at state expense. And when completed, the state was to operate them. This ambitious plan had scarcely been put onto the statute books when a very severe business depression hit the country. Governor Mason became entangled in a tragically confused business deal connected with borrowing the $5 million which had been authorized. In spite of the threatening business and financial conditions in 1837, work on the various projects was pushed ahead energetically. Surveyors and engineers set out from Detroit with pack horses bearing instruments. The northern route was located most easily because there were fewer towns along the route clamoring for the rails to enter their precincts. The line to Grand Haven from Detroit was measured at 201 miles. The central route ran 153 miles, and the southern route extended 183 miles. Estimates of cost were calculated at amounts which to us would seem ludicrously small. The engineers, for instance, estimated that the line of what is now the Michigan Central could be built from Detroit to St. Joseph for $1,700,000. The state took over the old Detroit and St. Joseph Railroad property and continued grading westward and started building from Detroit. The method was somewhat as follows. First, the ground was cleared to a width of about 14 feet and graded. Parallel trenches were then dug, in which were laid sills about a foot wide and 5 inches thick. Cross ties were then laid on these sills, and to them were spiked the rails of white oak. The upper surface of the white oak rails was then covered with iron straps. The straps were thin and often tore loose, coming up through the floor of the passenger cars to the discomfiture of the patrons. Kent Sagendorf, in his new biography of young Governor Mason, tells the amusing story of the first train trip from Detroit to Ypsilanti. All the big shots, including the governor, went along. Well, the engine continually broke down, and finally it gave out altogether on the return trip, and the wilted dignitaries had to find other means of returning to Detroit. The southern line was built as far west as Hillsdale by the state, and a branch line running up northward to Jackson was also acquired. About $75,000 was spent to survey, clear, and grub the northern route as far as Lapeer. No rails were laid, though. For a time, the right-of-way was utilized as a wagon road, but in 1847 it was sold to a private company. Most of the resources of the state went into building the central line. Now it appears that this central railroad was operated at a profit by the state, but all the income was poured back into constructing the line further west. People along the line were wildly enthusiastic about the railroad. In the American Railroad Journal, dated February 15, 1834, there's a letter from a man traveling through Michigan who tells of a big railroad meeting in Marshall at that early date. When the rails finally arrived, it was, of course, the occasion for enthusiastic demonstrations. It was early in the month of February, 1846, that the first train chugged into Kalamazoo over the line of the newly constructed road. At Kalamazoo, the state decided to get out of the railroad business. The Southern Line was sold to a private company, the Michigan Southern, and the line through Kalamazoo was disposed of to another group, the Michigan Central. Other railroad companies were rapidly organized, and building proceeded very quickly under private control. In the Constitution of Michigan, framed in 1850, there was a provision that the state should never again become a party to a project for internal improvement. All three of the railroads projected by the state were completed by the time of the Civil War. In 1846, when the Michigan Central reached Kalamazoo, it was becoming apparent that the city of Chicago was going to become the great railroad center of the West. Accordingly, the new owners began to lay rails toward Chicago just as fast as they could. The Southern Line originally was planned to run from Monroe to New Buffalo. And incidentally, that latter town, New Buffalo, as its name indicates, had expansive dreams of becoming a great Western city. But the growth of Chicago prevented that dream from being realized. The Southern Road veered southward into Indiana and headed straight for Chicago. Now that it wasn't a state project any longer, there was no reason to remain on Michigan soil. The story of the sale of the Michigan Central by the state is a fascinating one. It centers around a youngster of 26 named John W. Brooks. He was in Michigan and heard that the state wanted to sell the Central Line. Well, the road was in a decrepit condition. It had almost no repairing facilities, few real depots, and scanty ramshackle equipment. Brooks dashed back to Boston, where he ran into a stone wall of resistance by the State Street financiers. Failing in Boston, he went to New York and talked to the officials of the Farmers Bank and Trust Company, which had some of the defaulted Michigan bonds. Well, of course, they wanted to see someone buy the railroad and restore the state's credit, and so they were willing to give what help they could. Brooks then came back to Detroit and interested James F. Joy, a lawyer and a native of New Hampshire. Brooks and Joy conferred with the state legislators, who agreed to sell out the 153-mile railroad for $2 million, specifying that the buyer must complete it to Lake Michigan in 3 years and replace the wooden rails with 60-pound T-rails from end to end. The stipulations were accepted, and the new road was chartered. In January and February 1847, the total receipts of the railroad amounted to only $53,000. The first annual report for 1847 shows that only 13 miles had been located beyond Kalamazoo, but after that, progress was more rapid. Well, one important decision which the new owners had to make was whether to build the road from Kalamazoo to St. Joseph or to swing southwestward beyond Kalamazoo. The desire to reach Chicago by the shortest route may have been one factor in the decision not to build through St. Joseph. One story has it that the bridging of the St. Joseph River at Niles was regarded as easier than at Benton Harbor and St. Joseph. There are several interesting stories connected with the decision, but we don't have time to tell them here. The line west of Kalamazoo was not built along the present route of the railroad. Between Kalamazoo and Lawton, the original Michigan Central ran considerably south of the present route. It went through Oshkimo, and then it meandered onwards toward Mattawan. Many years afterward, the line was relocated, and the original right-of-way was sold to the little railroad from South Haven to Lawton, which desired to run its cars through to Kalamazoo. That was the Kalamazoo, Lakeshore, and Chicago Railroad, sometimes called the Fruit Belt Line. For many years, it entered Kalamazoo alongside the Michigan Central and terminated at a depot which is now used by a trucking firm, just east of where the Michigan Central crosses West Main Street. The KLS&C has long disappeared, but if you look carefully along the highway west of the city, you could still discern this old right-of-way. In general, the attitude of the pioneers was favorable to the railroads. Not until after the Panic of 1873 was there general criticism of the operation of the lines. But here in Michigan, during the 1850s, a storm of protest arose, which merits a footnote in the history of transportation. While the old strap rails were in use, the trains had to run slowly. Livestock straying onto the right-of-way had time to get off the rails. But when the new owners of the road replaced these strap rails and properly ballasted the roadbed, the faster movement of trains was made possible. Well, then, the slaughter of oxen and horses and sheep and swine became alarming. At first, the railroad paid the full value of the animals killed. But in 1849, the president of the company announced that henceforth only one half of the value would be paid. Well, the farmers were up in arms, and lawlessness broke out all along the line, especially in the area between Marshall and Ann Arbor. They burned wood piles, they derailed trains by placing heavy obstructions on the rails, they threw stones and they took pot shots at engineers, firemen, and even passengers. In the autumn of 1850, interference became so serious that the railroad hired detectives to discover the ringleaders and bring them to bar. The lawless acts reached a climax in 1851, when the large depot at Detroit was burned to the ground. The following April, two leaders and 36 others were arrested near Jackson. A trial lasting until September followed these arrests. It was a remarkable trial in many ways, with the very best legal talent available engaged by the opposing sides. The defense secured the very noted William H. Seward of New York, who was a very noted politician of the time. Two of the defendants died in jail. Several of the others were convicted and sent to prison. Well, that stopped the lacks of lawlessness, but the feeling against the railroad persisted for a long time. Next week, we will bring you the story of the plank roads of pioneer days. Now, this is Willis Dunbar bidding you a very pleasant good evening.